The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, your podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeal. I'm your host, John Ross, joined this week by Paul Sherman and Evan Burnick. This week on the show, nursing student speech, the CFPB's unconstitutional structure, the right to travel in Memphis, and compelled speech at pregnancy counseling centers. Paul, kick us off.
Sure. So the first case we're going to talk about is called Craig Keith v. Beth Adams et al. Craig Keith was a nursing student, and he got kicked out of nursing school. And this case raises some really interesting questions about the interaction of the First Amendment with off-campus speech. What happened in this case is Mr. Keith apparently was dissatisfied with the conduct of some of his classmates. He complained about them on Facebook. He had a post where he was complaining about people using this electric pencil sharpener. It bothered him. So he threatened to give someone a hemopneumothorax, which is apparently a puncture to the lung. This is it's pretty clear, I think, from the context that these were not actual threats he was making. He was just blowing off steam on his Facebook page. But this bothered one of his classmates who reported it to the administration. The administration met with him. He was totally unrepentant about what he said, and they kicked him out because they said that he had violated the academic standards of the program, one of which is that he has to treat his fellow nurses with respect. So the question in this case is, does that requirement violate the First Amendment?
Right. So there are really two questions on this case. One is the First Amendment issue, and second is the process that preceded his dismissal from the program. He was actually not presented with the specific contents of what he had done wrong or was said to have done wrong until the meeting itself. He wasn't given anything resembling notice that was in any way separated in time from the meeting regarding its content. And as Paul mentioned, this really does tap into a broader question of what one does with off-campus speech. Although the court in this case treats this as something resembling speech in the context of an educational program because he refers to a surgical procedure in blowing off steam, that's really not what's going on here. He's blowing off steam on Facebook. He's doing so off-campus. And the question is how you deal with that speech in the context of the First Amendment. The leading case that gets brought up in this context is Tinker v. Des Moines, and this is a case that involves on campus, in class, substantial disruption. In that case, the court said, despite the fact that students have First Amendment rights, if they disrupt the educational environments sufficiently, nonetheless, they can be disciplined. But the court never spoke to off-campus speech, and the Supreme Court has yet to step in decisively. The result is, well, very disappointing and diluted due process and First Amendment protection.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that is also going on here is Tinker v. Des Moines, the case that Evan just referred to, involved kids who were in high school. So they're still in the public school system. This case involves people who are in a collegiate level program. And it's not clear that we should treat college age kids the same way that we treat kids who are 13, 14, 15 years old when it comes to the extent of their First Amendment rights. We typically expect that if you are an adult, you should enjoy the full protection of the First Amendment when you're out in the real world. And that doesn't really happen in this case. I think the court was way too credulous about the possible disruption that this speech could have on the program. Unfortunately, this guy gets kicked out of the nursing program. There is a dissent in the case which makes the contrary argument, but, you know, things didn't work out in this case for Mr. Keefe.
Honestly, this outcome doesn't really bother me. If you're going to be a nursing student, if you're going to be a nurse and you're going to be taking care of people, maybe you should have enough maturity not to be making threats over Facebook. Even if you think you're blowing off steam, a reasonable person could certainly feel threatened by them.
Yeah, and so this gets into sort of the line drawing problem that exists when you're trying to distinguish threats from other types of speech. I certainly, under the existing precedent, I don't think that anyone could look at this speech and say that Mr. Keefe was engaged in true threats, that he was actually threatening people, and that people should have genuinely feared for their safety based on what he said. I think he probably is a jerk, and it doesn't sound like a super pleasant person. I probably wouldn't want to work with him. But you know, the First Amendment protects your right to be a jerk, and as long as you're not doing that in the classroom or doing it in your academic assignments where it's affecting the actual academic program that you're involved in, you know, it may be nice for us to draw these kinds of standards of conduct in the sense that we want people to behave that way, but that doesn't mean that the First Amendment allows the government to do that.
Right. And just building off on that, there's really no question that this is constitutionally protected speech. It doesn't qualify as a true threat. It doesn't fall outside anything the Supreme Court has identified as the scope of the First Amendment. Supreme Court has taken pains in recent years to narrow the categories of constitutionally unprotected speech, say that they have to be deeply entrenched in history. They courts can't create them on kind of an ad hoc basis. And what the court did in this case was essentially shoehorn constitutionally protected speech into a limited context in which it has been very deferential to schools in particular, which is speech that is done in the context of an educational program that supposedly has the school's imprimatur. The problem with that, at least in this case, is that there's really no colorable, plausible argument that the school was backing or endorsing his speech and therefore has essentially free rein to censor it. So you can say that this guy was a jerk. He acted inconsistently with the school's handbook, and it's hard to feel a great deal of sympathy for him. But the case really does highlight the Supreme Court's or a tension within the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on the one hand between very strident protection for free speech more broadly and very narrow categories for unprotected speech on the one hand, and this very limited zone in which there's very limited speech protection within the context of an educational environment. Schools are trying to expand that exception, and this court has basically facilitated that.
Just to kind of make a final point on this, I think, John, part of what may be driving your feelings on this is an intuition that I share, which I think is a very libertarian intuition, which is that this guy entered this program and he agreed to abide by the standards that are set out in this handbook. And, you know, coming from, you know, sort of the libertarian intuition that people should be allowed to enter into contracts and agreements about the way that they're going to behave in certain situations, that actually seems like it might be reasonable to hold him to that deal. And if this were a private institution, there would be no First Amendment issue here at all.
Or due process issue.
Yeah, or due process issue. What introduces these things is the fact that this is a public institution, and so it's limited in the scope of the type of agreements that it can enter into with its students.
Okay, let's move on to the next case. Evan.
So this case comes out of the D.C. Circuit. It involves a relatively new and very powerful and very independent federal agency. It's the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and it is empowered to essentially unilaterally enforce about 17 consumer protection statutes covering vast swaths of American life. This case actually arose from an enforcement action worth several hundred millions of dollars brought against a mortgage lender by the consumer, CPFB. The mortgage lender turned around and challenged that enforcement action on the grounds that the CFPB is actually unconstitutional, despite the fact that the Supreme Court has acquiesced in the creation of independent executive agencies, independent in the sense that their members and the people who head them are not removable at the will of the president, but removable only for cause. This particular agency is headed only by a single person. That is a unique creation in American law, and the court considers the question of whether to extend the precedent that says, yes, independent agencies can be created, to the creation of single-headed agencies.
Just let's back up for a second. What does it mean to be removable for cause?
Removable for cause means you need to give a reason, you need to have a justification, you need to have process before you can remove somebody. Whereas if you have an executive, is somebody who's subordinate to the executive and they can be removable at will, all the president has to do is fire you.
Yeah, and so this gets at something that is sometimes called a debate over what's called the unitary executive theory. The Constitution says that the executive power shall be vested in the president of the United States. And so there are some people who interpret that to mean that the president has unilateral authority to basically fire anyone who is in the executive branch of government. He's like the CEO. And if he doesn't like someone who's the head of one of the executive agencies whom he has appointed, he can just fire that person for any reason or for no reason. Starting during the New Deal, what we saw was the rise of what are called independent executive agencies. So these are agencies that are designed to be insulated from that kind of removal. The president can only fire the people who are in charge of these agencies if he has some good reason for doing so. They've engaged in some kind of malfeasance or misfeasance. And that was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court in a case called Humphrey's Executor, which remains a controversial decision to this day. As a result of that decision, we have all of these agencies out there, like the Federal Election Commission, for example, where the folks who are in charge of that, the FEC commissioners, can't be fired by the president just because. He's got to have some good reason for doing it. And the trade-off is that there's a lot less – they are – in some ways insulated from the political beliefs of the presidency, but there's also a lot less political accountability because there's no way, you know, if you kick the president out of office, it has really no effect on these people.
So the really fascinating thing about this case, or at least the part that I found fascinating, is that you have a court here that clearly thinks that Humphrey's Executor was decided incorrectly, that we do have a unitary executive, that insofar as you have executive officers, they need to be directly supervised by the president, and they need to be removable at will. However, precedent is precedent, and the question is, well, do you extend that precedent into a relatively new context, or do you cabinet? The court essentially cabineted in this case. It said that in respect of the fact that the Supreme Court has signed off on independent agencies as such. It has not signed off on independent agencies headed by a single person with the kind of power that the CFPB has. And the reason that it does this is substantially because of what the court understands to be the function of the requirements that executive officers be supervised directly and removable at will in the first place, which is namely the possibility of a unilateral use of coercive power to further ends that are not consistent with the legitimate purposes of government. That particular danger is particularly heightened when you have only a single member as opposed to several individuals who can deliberate together, who can restrain each other's actions, who can exert influence upon how the agency acts.
So in the facts of this case, we actually do have an example of what seems to be coercive behavior. Paul, can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So we've talked about this case a lot. We haven't talked too much about what the actual underlying legal dispute was, which will require a little bit of explanation. The mortgage company that had this action brought against it was charged with engaging in an illegal, what's called a captive mortgage reinsurance agreement. I had no idea what that was. I had to look up what it was. Here's what it is. Think about an insurance policy that you have, like you go out and you get auto insurance. So if your car is damaged, the insurer pays out your insurance. It bears all that risk. Well, what insurers will do is they'll try to mitigate that risk, and they will pass some of the premiums on to a secondary insurer. And so if your car is damaged and they have to pay out the money, you'll get the money from your insurance company, but they'll get some of that money back from the reinsurance company that they're working with. Well, something that started happening in the 90s was that mortgage lenders would say, you know, if you want to get this mortgage, you have to have mortgage insurance. And they would enter into they would then also create a secondary insurance company. And so you would go get your mortgage insurance from mortgage insurance company one, and they would reinsure that policy with this captive mortgage company that was created by the original lender. So the legal question in this case, apart from the constitutional issues, was, is that kind of arrangement legal, or is it an illegal form of kickback to the original company? When this went before the ALJ, the administrative law judge, the ALJ said, yeah, you're not allowed to do that, and we're imposing a fine of $6.5 million against the mortgage company. Well, this gets appealed to the head of the CFPB, And he says, I agree that you're not allowed to do it, but I'm expanding the scope of this and I'm increasing the fine to $109 million. So it's a tremendous amount of power being put in the hands of this one person to take what was actually a quite radical interpretation of this statute, and one that ultimately, apart from settling all these constitutional issues, the D.C. Circuit rejects this interpretation and says, as long as you're paying a commercially reasonable amount of money for this reinsurance, that's perfectly legal. The law does not prohibit that.
Right. And what the D.C. Circuit really recognizes in this case is that these kind of facts, these kind of circumstances are precisely the kind of thing that the unitary executive, the vesting of the executive power in the president, was designed to prevent. It illustrates the very kind of unsupervised unilateral action by executive officers that the unique vesting of the executive power in the president was designed to avoid. And it reacts to that and comes to what I believe is the correct outcome.
Which is?
That the particular structure of the CFPB in terms of just having one person at the top is unconstitutional. The CFPB stays, but the director of the CFPB is now removable at the will of the president.
Do they need to appoint a slew of commissioners now, or does it stay one person?
It stays one person right now. Okay. That person is now removable at will, not for cause.
Okay, let's move on to the next case.
Sure. The next case is out of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and it raises some interesting questions about the constitutional right to intra-state travel, so travel within a single state. I think this is particularly interesting because, you know, oftentimes when we get into debates about the Constitution, you'll hear questions like, well, where is that in the Constitution? You know, the First Amendment, the freedom of speech, that's clearly in the Constitution. But where is the right to earn an honest living in the Constitution? I guess it's not protected by the Constitution. We disagree with that approach. And this case similarly involves an unenumerated right that it seems intuitively obvious that all of us must have, which is the right to travel freely within a particular state. So the case involves an off-duty police officer who's leaving a bar at around 3 in the morning in the city of Memphis, and he gets arrested under this policy that they have where on this particular street in Memphis between 3 a.m. and 5 a.m., the police just have this policy of forcing everybody to leave the sidewalks and street. And that's just what they do. And they do it regardless of whether there's any particular threat to public safety, or people are being rowdy or boisterous or whatever. They just have this street clearing policy. So this officer gets arrested under that policy, and he challenges it and says that's unconstitutional. It violates my right to intrastate travel. And it goes up to the Sixth Circuit and he prevails. The court holds that they did violate his right to interstate travel. And it's got some interesting discussion about how we determine what is a fundamental constitutional right, and also what standard of judicial scrutiny we should apply to fundamental constitutional rights.
Right. That's the thing. What really the reason the question of whether this is a fundamental right matters is because that if it was not, you would get relegated to the vagaries of rational basis of review. That's the default standard of review in constitutional cases, and it is so sweepingly deferential that at least in certain cases in which the Supreme Court has formulated it, it's a virtually irrebuttable presumption of constitutionality that the government gets. So if police officers could sweep people off the streets between, what is it, 3 to 5 a.m.
In the morning, an entertainment district.
And they got rational basis review, there's basically no way that this plaintiff could have prevailed in this case. But because he's able to point to, and the court recognizes a right to, a fundamental right to interstate travel, he gets what I would consider an engaged approach. The court looks at the particular facts of the case. They look to the fact that the officers, by their own admission, do not respond on the basis of commotion or blocking of the streets or chaos that they see on the streets. They just, from 3 to 5 a.m. At these given nights, clear the streets.
Which actually has the sort of the perverse effect of the bars in Memphis are open until 5 a.m. So yeah. The effect of this is that it's pushing all of these people off of the sidewalks and streets and back into the bars.
Right. And I mean, you can prompt hostile encounters with police for this in this context. I mean, these people are out late and all of a sudden these cops are all over the place. You know, it's not a great situation. But this case is a lot more complicated than I think it should be. The bottom line question is, do states or do police officers exercising the coercive power of the state need to give you a justification before they physically shove you away from a given location? The answer is yes. The states and police do not have the constitutional authority to push you around for no reason. So even without getting into the fundamental right question, the initial question whenever there's an exercise of government power is there a justification? Is it grounded in a legitimate function of governments? And is it calculated to effectuate that legitimate function of government?
Okay, Evan, let's move to the Ninth Circuit for the final case.
Yeah, so this case comes out of the Ninth Circuit. It involves California's new Reproductive Freedom, Accountability, Comprehensive Care, and Transparency Act, or the FACT Act. And what this act does, it has two components. It requires licensed pregnancy-related centers to disseminate a notice concerning the availability of family planning services, including contraception and abortion. And it also requires unlicensed clinics to give people notice that they are unlicensed clinics. The case itself involves a constitutional challenge brought by licensed clinics that object on conscientious grounds to identifying the availability of abortion to people who come to them. And they basically say this is an example of the government compelling them to speak. And compelled speech is something that's protected, or the freedom not to speak is protected by the First Amendment no less than the freedom to speak. Therefore, there are constitutional questions that need to be resolved. One important thing to keep in mind about the context of this particular act is that it was drafted with the goal of dealing with what legislators perceive to be a problem with pregnancy counseling centers. The idea is that these are counseling centers are discouraging women from having abortions. They are preventing them from having access. Therefore, we need to deal with it. So although the act is framed in terms that are supposedly content neutral, it is in fact content based in terms in its intent.
Yeah, and so this case raises an issue that IJ litigates a lot, which is the intersection of the First Amendment, the freedom to speak, and then sort of the freedom to engage in a business. Although in this case, these are not nonprofit organizations. Yeah. They don't charge people who come in. But you know, how does the government's power to regulate sort of medical or health-related fields interact with the freedom to give people advice or speak to people about these topics, and to do so on your own terms, to frame the discussion in the way that you think is most appropriate? You know, the reason that these organizations, which are frequently called crisis pregnancy centers, object to having to start their conversation with someone by saying, "Hey, just so you know, you know, the state provides all of these abortion services," is because that changes the entire tone of their conversation with these people.
It's kind of an inverse example of laws that exist in a couple of states that require people who perform abortions or clinicians to inform people about specific risks of abortion, even risks that are not medically substantiated. So it's the same issue with compelled speech in a slightly different context.
Yeah, although you know, one of the distinctions is, so the issue that Evan just mentioned has went up to the Supreme Court in a decision called Casey, where it talked about, you know, whether physicians who perform abortions can be forced to give certain information to their patients. And the Supreme Court ultimately held that they could. I think something that distinguishes that case from this case is that there you've got people who are engaged in an actual medical procedure. And as part of that medical procedure, the government is saying to get informed consent for this medical procedure, you have to provide this additional information to, you know, the patient. You know, there are, I think, difficult First Amendment questions that go along with that. You know, what's the scope of the informed consent? Is it being given for genuine medical necessity, or is it really just designed to discourage people? But here we've got groups that are really not doing medical procedures. You know, they do ultrasounds, they do pregnancy testing, but they're not performing abortions, and yet they are being required to tell people facts about abortion.
So what's interesting about this case is that the court acknowledges that this is a content-based speech restriction or a content-based speech compulsion, in that it compels crisis pregnancy centers and other institutions to communicate information about a particular subject that they would not otherwise communicate. The Supreme Court recently reaffirmed in a decision called Reed v. Town of Gilbert that content-based restrictions or content-based distinctions that focus on speech trigger the most stringent level of constitutional scrutiny you can get if you are talking about constitutionally protected speech, and that is strict scrutiny. The court in this case acknowledges Reed, but then relies upon pre-Reed decisions that seem to cast doubt upon whether the courts or whether the Ninth Circuit is actually obliged to comply with the most relevant precedent on point.
Yeah, it's rather tendentious. I mean, they say, we're aware that Reed says that all content-based restrictions on speech get strict scrutiny. But of course, we know that not all content-based burdens on speech get strict scrutiny, because here are some decisions we handed down before Reed versus Town of Gilbert in which there was a content-based restriction and we didn't give it strict scrutiny. Now, under the system of precedent that we have in American federal courts, what that should suggest is that under Reed v. Town of Gilbert, all that old precedent is questionable now, maybe wrong, maybe it's been implicitly overruled by Reed. And instead, what the court does is it deploys this this analysis that the Ninth Circuit has used in other cases, where it says that in this sort of occupational speech field, there's a range of standards that we might use where for certain cases, we might use strict scrutiny. For other cases, we might use rational basis scrutiny. In this case, we're going to apply a form of intermediate scrutiny, and we hold that the law is constitutional under that level. The level of scrutiny they employ is ultimately very squishy, and I think they really overlook the fact that the government has other ways that it could achieve the things that it wants to achieve here, such as through an advertising campaign. The government could promote these services on its own. It doesn't need to conscript these organizations into providing the promotion for them.
Right. And, the two points that I would make in response to that, or building on that rather, is that, to the extent that, yes, that you have a slightly different context and the court is now considering, well, can we reconcile Reed with Casey? Can we reconcile Reed with previous abortion cases? Well, all of that is very interesting, but Reed itself is actually very unambiguous on this point. If you have a content-based restriction on speech, it is strict scrutiny, period, end of story. The court not only evades that, but then goes on to apply a form of intermediate scrutiny that really reduces intermediate scrutiny to something akin to rational basis review. I mean, there's no effort to demonstrate or to highlight any evidence that the government has brought to bear that this particular means of communicating the information that the government wants to communicate is responsive to a genuine need, and that even if it was responsive to a genuine need, it was substantially narrowly tailored to that need.
I will just add that the Ninth Circuit's decision on this is almost certainly not going to be the last word on this issue. This is something that has recurred in other circuits. There are decisions from the Second and Fourth Circuit that have applied strict scrutiny to these kinds of restrictions. Eventually, I think a case like this is going to get to the U.S. Supreme Court, which will have to provide some clarity on it.
Right, because either Reed meant what it said or it didn't.
Okay, that concludes the show. Thanks for listening. Until next time, this is John Ross from the Institute for Justice, browbeating you to get engaged.